Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time to take our dive into the news stories of the week. And with me to my right is Adrian Reynolds, Head of National Ministries.
Thank you. Welcome back.
Good morning. Indeed. Yep. It's lovely to see you. And John Stevens, our National Director, is here as well. Good morning.
Hi, Phil.
John.
Good morning.
Good holidays, gentlemen.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. It was a while ago for me, but yeah very good.
You were away in July. John, you've just got back.
Yeah, I've just got back. We had a nice time in South Wales, in Pembrokeshire.
Good.
Great with the family. And then we had kind of A-level results intruded into that. Mm. So my son is about to head off to university. So it's been a good summer. Thank
you. Excellent. Well, welcome back. Lots has been going on over the summer, but let's try and push on things that have happened in recent days. I want to start with the death of Mikhail Gorbachev. So obviously a statesman from the 1980s, those famous talks with Thatcher, ultimately brought to an end kind of communism, the communist bloc, really, in that sense, as he was head of the Soviet Union. And one of the things that hasn't been talked about, unsurprisingly, in the news, but is important, is that brought about freedom of religion, didn't it, John, for many people in those parts of the world that were affected by communism?
I guess Mikhail Gorbachev has disappeared from public view for a very long period of time, but he was in many ways a remarkable figure. And if we believe biblically that God raises up leaders to accomplish his purpose, I think we can at least recognize that God's hand seemed to be in raising up Mikhail Gorbachev at a particular moment that sought to bring an end to the Soviet Union and its oppression of people in Western Europe. And in many ways, nobody has changed the shape of the modern world more in the last half century or so than Mikhail Gorbachev. I mean, it's a remarkable story of a man who rose to kind of the dominant position in the Communist Party in the Soviet Union at a time in which there was massive tension between the West and the Eastern Bloc. I mean, those of us who were growing up in the 80s genuinely lived in fear of nuclear war breaking out in a way that we haven't really experienced since 1989.
We were the Tom Clancy generation, weren't we?
Absolutely. I think Red Storm Cruise Rising. Missiles, and, SS-20s. Yeah. And Mikhail Gorbachev, to his credit, recognized that the communist system needed a change. And it took a leader from within who had that power to be able to bring about that kind of change. Maybe there's a leadership lesson there. Sometimes it's only somebody from within the system who is able to bring it down. And in many ways, he dismantled the system from which he had benefited because he believed that that was the right thing to do. Now, he wanted to reform the communist system. He didn't really want to see it kind of ended. But again, he did introduce greater openness, freedom of speech within Russia, greater freedom to dissidents, greater freedom of religion, a degree of economic liberalization. And I think actually his decision not to seek to uphold communism by force, particularly in Eastern European countries that had been communist from the Second World War, was a remarkable act of generosity that allowed countries to become free. It led to revolutions in kind of East Germany, in Romania, in what was then Czechoslovakia. And in a remarkably peaceful way, the Iron Curtain came down and there was transformation of the political situation. And that did have huge impacts for Christians in Eastern Europe. It liberated opportunities for the gospel. And that period from the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, really on into the early 21st century, was a remarkable period of gospel growth, as missionaries poured in and a whole generation of people who'd grown up under communism had the opportunity to hear the gospel. Many people were converted, church leaders raised up, ministries established. Now, to some extent, secularism has come in even to kind of Eastern Europe, and you've got the increasing repression in kind of the sort of Russia under Putin. But Gorbachev was a hugely significant figure.
And we see that, don't we? Because you and I both attend the European Leadership Forum in Wisla in Poland each year. And there's kind of 800 people there, I guess, from all over Europe, a lot from Eastern Europe, and a lot of a younger generation who have never known communism, but are flourishing as Christians in churches that are flourishing in places like Ukraine and Romania and the Czech Republic and Slovakia and Slovenia and Poland and all those sorts of places where the gospel essentially was just put down by communist authorities or by the Orthodox Church in league with the communist authorities, sometimes the Catholic Church. It's just, it's wonderful to see them thriving. And actually, it's interesting, at that conference, there are one or two people who remember the old communist days. Jan, a pastor that many people will know from Slovakia. And if you speak to him, he kind of almost with tears in his eyes describes how they've gone from sort of essentially being an underground church to being able to be out in the open, and just the blessing that's been able to be in terms of reaching out with the gospel. So it's a great story. But you are right. In some places, especially in Russia itself, in the Russian Federation, we see basically a reversal of those freedoms. So we see anti-conversion laws being passed. We see that it's very difficult for evangelicals to speak out, to organise activities, to rent buildings, all those kinds of things. So there is, I think it's great to be thankful and optimistic, but it's also good to be realistic, actually, about the things that are being reversed now under Putin.
A mate of mine married a girl in Poland, and we went to the wedding in Poland, and it was really interesting because she was an evangelical, but they were seen as cults, really, amongst at that stage, it was probably 10 years ago. Yeah. That was quite interesting, isn't it? So even though all that has happened, there's still a skepticism about evangelicalism because it wasn't the Orthodox Church or the Catholic Church.
I think that's a particular issue in Poland. I think even in the communist period, the Roman Catholic Church was the centre of opposition to communism in Poland, and that means there's a particular view towards evangelicalism within Poland, that the dominance of Catholicism has meant that evangelicals are perceived in that way. So I think Poland is unique in terms of the nature of the Catholic opposition to kind of communism. I listened to a very interesting series of podcasts, the kind of Rest Is History podcast with Tom Holland, Dominic Sandbrook, talking about the whole era of Gorbachev into Yeltsin. It was fascinating. I think things did go wrong in the Soviet Union. People's standards of living did fall dramatically. That was a kind of a capitalism that was very corrupt. But most of that was actually due to the rule of Yeltsin rather than actually what Gorbachev himself had done. So it's another reminder that sort of good change can so easily be undone by those who want to take advantage of it. If there are a couple of leadership lessons from Gorbachev that I was just thinking of, I think his willingness to change and break with ideology that he could see was no longer right is a really good quality in leaders, not simply to cling to things and cling on to their own power, but to be able to kind of give it away. Another characteristic of his, unlike the older Soviet leaders who were very distant from the people, he engaged with the people, he met with them, he talked with them, he sort of went on walkabouts with them, he engaged with the people that he was serving. Again, I think that's a real lesson for church leaders, not to have that distance between themselves. And the other thing that really touched me in his obituary, he had a real deep love for his wife, Raisa. They'd met at university, married, and obviously inseparable for 46 years. She died some years ago. He then set up a leukemia foundation to help treat children with leukemia, which is what his wife had died from. But the thing that really got me is afterwards, he recorded an album of Russian ballads in honor of his wife, which is singing them himself.
He sang them.
Absolutely. And it was issued under the title Songs for Raisa. And I just thought there's just something touching about that very human kind of
love. And there is some extraordinary footage, actually, of him with the BBC's Russian correspondent, him playing the piano, the BBC correspondent, and Gorbachev singing along sort of in his late 80s. And it's quite moving.
Fantastic. So we've talked a bit about Mikhail Gorbachev, his legacy, perhaps his legacy to Christians as well in terms of freedom of religion. Let's bring freedom of religion a bit closer to home. So John, you picked up a story this week about a Royal Navy officer who refused to serve on a nuclear submarine citing religious reasons and is now claiming discrimination on the grounds of religion because he's been removed from his post. Just outline that for us.
Yeah, I just thought it was an extraordinary story. I mean, obviously freedom of religion is hugely important. We want to live in a society in which people have the right to be able to express their religious beliefs. Actually, there's been, certainly in Western kind of culture, a long fight that culminated in a recognition of the importance of religious freedom and allowing religious worship and allowing people to live by religious conscience. But kind of the edges of how that works out are really worth thinking about, I think. And it seems to me this is an extraordinary story of someone who had become a Royal Navy officer, trained for the submarine service, was then appointed to serve on HMS Vanguard, which is one of the four kind of Trident boats that carry the British nuclear deterrent. He actually had the nickname Trigger because his colleagues knew that he wouldn't push the trigger. And he clearly had a moral objection to nuclear weapons. And it's worth recognizing Christians have different views on nuclear weapons. So for some, they see them as deeply immoral and that the country shouldn't have them. For others, they might see them as being a legitimate deterrent that help kind of maintain kind of peace. So there are different Christian views on that. But he was then, I think, rather understandably removed from the submarine on which he was serving. And is now taking action, claiming that he's been discriminated against on the grounds of his faith. Now, at one level, I think the issue here is having joined the Royal Navy, if you join the Royal Navy, all the armed forces more generally, you know that you are buying into an organization that exists to maintain and deploy the British nuclear deterrent, that believes that that's a key part of foreign policy, defense policy. Even if you're in the other forces, ultimately, our strategy involves a nuclear kind of strategy. So you know what you're going into. And I think at that sense, you can't quite have the right of private conscience that says, having made that choice voluntarily, I now sort of want to pick and choose what I'm willing to do in the service. Surely the appropriate moral point to make that decision was the point of deciding to enlist and to train and to serve. Because we don't have people who are conscripted. It's a free choice to engage in that way. And I think just a reminder to us there, we mustn't take our faith and issues of conscience to an inappropriate level. The fact that we believe in religious freedom doesn't mean to say that as a Christian, you therefore automatically have the right to do everything and in every context to impose your conscience on everybody else. If you choose to join a company, for example, that is wanting to support Pride, maybe that is involved actively in the support of kind of political organizations that you don't agree with, in a sense, you've chosen to join. And at one level, I think at that point, you can't complain if you're expected to comply with what the organization does. So you have a moral choice, but you have to exercise that at the appropriate moment.
So can I just push back on that a little bit? So not perhaps with the situation with the Royal Navy, but if you join a secular organization that then decides to support Pride and is forcing that upon you, does that change things slightly? Thoughts on that?
I mean, I think there are a whole level of questions there. Does the organization force you to support it, or is that you object to the organization supporting it? So there's a question of what are you personally being required to do? Are you being required to wear a badge, a flag?
A rugby jersey.
Well,
that's been
laces
in the news,
for the cricketers.
Yeah.
So I think that it's not straightforward and not simplistic. Many firms will sensibly make accommodations to staff who do have different moral positions on those areas. So people from perhaps other ethnicities, other religions who might also have strong views on that. But I think as a basic principle, what I'm trying to say is you can't go into something where you know what you're signing up for and then, as it were, pull out the Christian card and claim that somehow your conscience has been kind of impinged. You made the choice if you joined up knowing what it was you were agreeing to. Yeah.
And we need to be clear that not everything, it sometimes feels like everything is going against us. You know, backs to the wall kind of approach. But actually, there's been a very interesting case this week of an FIC pastor, in fact, who's been in an employment tribunal. Keith Waters, who's pastor at West Street Evangelical Church in Carshalton, was a pastor of a church in Ely. And he worked for the church and funded the position by working as a school caretaker. And his employment is slightly complicated, but his employment came to an end because of a tweet he sent out of work hours, kind of on a sort of in a church view of pride marches and what Christians should think about them. And he actually resigned before he was sacked, but he would have been sacked. And so there was an employment tribunal. And again, the outcome of that is there's a number of different things they've ruled on. But essentially on that point, they ruled in his favor. And it's extraordinary. It's worth reading the judgment. Although his pastor, Keith Waters, W-A-T-E-R-S, but bizarrely, the court report, even the court report has misspelt his name, which seems to be, terribly sloppy. Anyway, so they've spelt it as Walters, but you can find it online. And basically, the judges who ruled, in something which seems to me to be reasonably extraordinary, but I'm not a lawyer, said actually they expressed an opinion on whether they agreed with him or not on the views he expressed. And they said, we don't agree with his views, but actually he did have the right to say them. So his case supported by the Christian Legal Center, they did a good job there and helped him out. And I think it's an important case in some ways. So I mean, all these cases have nuances and complexities. They're often not as simple as they are presented, but there are freedoms of religion for Christians, and they are actually being preserved by the court system.
Which is good to know. Speaking of kind of freedoms, we've got a declaration, the Frankfurt Declaration. This seems to be at an intersection between kind of civil liberties and the church. I confess I hadn't heard about this. First of all, just outline what is the Frankfurt Declaration?
Well, John has it in front of him. It's five articles, which are a mixture of affirmations and denials. Each one has an affirmation and a denial. Going to the heart of the relationship between church and state, at its most foundational, and then exploring how that relationship between church and state is worked out. I guess responding in part to interventions that governments have made over the last couple of years because of the pandemic, trying to set out the limits that there are in terms of what's what the state is able to rule over. And it's full of biblical quotes and references and then application as well.
And so what do we make of it? It's been signed by some prominent American pastors especially. I noticed there was some names that were missing when I looked at it yesterday that I thought might be on there. So it's not been signed by everybody. What would you make of it?
Can I just say something else about it before we get into the in meat of it? Just about declarations in general. People often ask why we don't sign them. We generally don't sign them. And that's because we have a basis of faith as the FIC, and which is agreed by churches. We have ethos statements, which are agreed by churches. And I think church leaders need to think about this. There is a, when you sign these declarations online, you are essentially adding or committing both yourself and to some extent the church, if you have a position of responsibility, and for us, the FIC, to a position that hasn't necessarily been considered by members or by churches and voted on. So I think there is a danger that we introduce clauses to our, essentially to our constitution and basis of faith by stealth. Now, it may be that you think the Frankfurt Declaration is an excellent thing. If so, you should think about it as a church. You should vote on it as a church, I think, and then sign up to it if that's what you want to do. But I think there is a danger in a top-down defining and ever-expanding basically, basis of faith. I think we've got to be a little bit cautious about that.
Thoughts, John?
Yeah, well, I think Christians have always gathered together to want to make statements and declarations that clarify their beliefs and what they think follows from their beliefs. Actually, the process of producing creeds, the process of producing confessions, statements of faith is all about that anyway. So that's part of our religious freedom to be able to do that. I think there's a difference between statements that are intended to be unifying in terms of stating things that all Christians ought to agree that are defining the very essence of the faith, and then statements that are reflecting a particular kind of interpretation, position, or secondary issue. There's a place for
both
of those. Well, I think in many ways, it seems to me that this flows out of a particular understanding of the nature of the relationship between the church and state, the way that God has given authority to the state. So it's a deeply theological statement. It's not a unifying statement.
So you're an Anglican, you can't sign it, can you?
Well, you can't really sign it as an Anglican because it basically says that the state has no jurisdiction over the church to regulate any of its affairs in matters of faith and practice. Now, actually, that would go against the very nature of establishment Christianity. That would be counter to the very essence of historic Anglicanism. I think it actually might be against the sort of principles of confessionalism, Presbyterianism, and others who believe that there's a right and proper role for the state, for the magistrate, for the prince.
But this is about overreach. This is about overreach.
Indeed, but I think it does reflect a particular view, a particular philosophy or theology of how church and state are to relate, a particular view of sphere sovereignty that tends to reflect more of an American kind of understanding of separation between church and state. So for those who agree with all of those positions, by all means, sign it. It clearly contains some really important biblical truths. I agree in large measure with a lot of what it says about God's sovereignty in creation, the limited authority that is given to the state, that it doesn't control every area of life, that we need to be on guard against creeping totalitarianism, that man is created in the image of God, that human secular moral values are not transcendent and binding and we shouldn't accept them, that science doesn't have the answer to every issue. So I think all Christians would agree with all of those general principles. How it gets worked out in terms of what it says the state can and can't do, Christians will disagree over. So we've already talked about it, saying there's no role for the state in regulating any matters of the church, which runs against historic magisterial reformation. I think it doesn't really define what it believes are the freedoms granted to all people. So whilst it's right that we want the state to uphold freedom, there's a question of what are those freedoms? So for example, some of the Christians associated with it haven't always necessarily been associated with, for example, freedom of other religions to be able to worship and practice. So I think the question of what are the freedoms that are granted, to what extent are we granted by God the freedom to sin and rebel, is another issue to be thought through. It makes the very categorical and absolute declaration that government has no authority to be able to mandate people in relation to issues of healthcare. Interestingly, I was reading a book over the holidays about 19th century Britain, and it was interesting. Government introduced mandatory vaccinations for children, which had massive implications in the 19th century for reducing infant mortality rates. Diseases like polio, smallpox, and others were virtually eliminated as a result of that, because it was essential that the entire population be vaccinated. Now, that would say that that was a completely inappropriate action on the part of the state. So I think, you know, that's a judgment that's being made. I'm not sure biblically I would be able to agree that the state would never have the power to take any of these actions. So, for example, it says the state can never command mask wearing. Well, the state can command seatbelts. So I think some of those practical applications I would personally find difficult to sign up to, even though I agree with actually the broad overall theological perspective. It also states that the church, the state should never take coercive measures over the church that criminalize, inhabit, or regulate any of its activities which are undertaken as acts of service towards its Lord. Well, we all accept, even in our Christian ministries, that a certain measure of health and safety legislation applies. The way that we for example, conduct our offering of food to people in the life of the church, if we would offer meals to the poor, the kind of the health and safety of our buildings, whether or not they're overcrowded, fire regulations. So inevitably, there are some measures of the state that do regulate the activities of churches. Churches may need to be registered as charities. They may need to observe kind of financial and accounting provisions. So again, I just find that an absolute position, that actually in practice, the vast majority of churches happily accept some measure of state regulation that means that they do what they do in an appropriate and
a safe
way.
And is this part of the challenge of putting application into creedal statements? So when your creedal statements declare, this is what we believe, about the nature of God or the nature of church or salvation or whatever it may be, it's more straightforward, if you like, to write those statements. We look and see what the Bible has to say, and we interpret it carefully, and we try and put it into our own words, perhaps. But actually, it's in the application sometimes of some of how these things are lived out in a broken world where the challenge is.
I think that's right. I think sort of another element of the statement it reflects actually almost an idealized version of how things should be. Whereas I think actually to some extent we have to live in a world that is broken, that is messed up, where it isn't like that. You kind of almost wonder if it were read by a Christian in the first century or maybe a Christian in China or in a country where there's significant persecution of Christians and deep restrictions.
Russia.
It would just seem entirely irrelevant to the situation in which they find themselves. Actually, it's predicated on a whole kind of Western Enlightenment understanding of the relationship between the state and the individual. Now, that raises the question of to what degree is that a biblical picture of how government is to be undertaken? So I don't think it kind of can be seen as a sort of a trans-historical, trans-cultural kind of absolute theological kind of statement.
Yeah. But it is online if you want to sign it, or if your church wants to read over it and debate it.
I mean, I do think the heart of what it's about, which is the danger of the state intruding in ways that are tyrannical, is hugely important. Mm. And as Christians, we need to be on guard against that. So whatever qualms I might have about the statement, that doesn't mean that I think that there isn't an issue to be thought through of how the power of the state is rightly restrained. And biblically, there is clearly a principle on the part of Christians to, at some points, if there's a conflict between Christ and the church, to obey Christ rather than the church, to obey Christ rather than the state, and take the consequences. And of course, in a democratic society, we have the option to be able to protest, to campaign, to critique government policy, to exercise our votes in appropriate ways. So a particular statement may have weaknesses or deficiencies, but actually the danger at which it is seeking to identify is one that we I think need to be on guard against. Mm.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Adrian. Let's stay in the States. Texas, particularly at the Village Church, Matt Chandler, the pastor there, is taking a leave of absence indefinitely from his ministry, citing an inappropriate, we're told non-sexual, non-romantic, but an inappropriate online relationship with sort of direct messages with a woman who was not his wife. Much has been written, said about this. It seems that Mr. Chandler made a statement to his church. I believe he received a standing ovation for that statement. There's been some sort of critique of what's happened after that. I mean, is what we're being told, is that a disqualifying?
It is just worth saying there are two source documents.
Okay.
So a huge amount has been written. And if you start Googling it, you'll go down all kinds of rabbit holes. The two source documents are a YouTube video, which is about 10 minutes long. That's Matt Chandler's statement to the church. And then there's a very brief statement on the ACT29 website. They're the only two things that have publicly been said. Okay. So everything else is kind sort of comment interpretation on, and comment on those.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's an important question. What we're being told, is that a disqualifying act for a man in ministry or woman?
Well, I think the answer is we don't know. So I think part of the problem is there are more questions to be answered, I think, that haven't been answered. And it does raise questions about transparency in some of these things. I mean, the context of a mega church in the States is so far removed, and a kind of celebrity pastor is so far removed from our experience that at one level, it's difficult to get your heads around it. But actually, the principle of as much transparency as possible, while still protecting people who have been victims or potential victims, is absolutely paramount, because all that happens is this speculation piles up and people ask questions and people actually aren't able to make judgments about whether the right things have been done or not.
John?
I think we need to sort of first of all recognise that yet again, the honour of Christ has been called into question by a kind of a leader who it's acknowledged has publicly fallen short, and that has huge implications for the gospel. It's tragic for kind of Acts 29, for the village church, for all the organisations that Chandler might have been involved in, and all the people who looked to him to provide kind of a godly leadership.
And for the other, we should say, for the other person involved in this whole discussion, who we don't know who that is, but a woman in the church.
So, I mean, I think it just reminds us of the huge importance of church leaders maintaining genuine godliness in every area of their life. No doubt this wasn't public ministry, this was sense private. It took place without people sort of in a sense knowing you, what you do on your phone, who you're speaking to some extent hidden. And I think it ought first of all to be a reminder to all of us of the vital importance to guard ourselves, that we don't fall into behavior that is discrediting of Christ, that requires a stepping back from ministry. Clearly, the church and those who've investigated felt there's something sufficiently serious for somebody to step back from ministry, but we don't know what all of the circumstances are. I think that, you know, it's obviously acknowledged there's some coarse joking that's been involved in this. And again, actually, the Bible says that's something we shouldn't engage in. That in itself is questionable. I think lots of attention has been focused on the fact that this is a woman. But I wonder how many pastors are in friendships with men that they engage in that kind of coarse joking in, that actually is just as equally inappropriate. I don't think we should want to just totally sexualize it. Actually, there are aspects of maybe what is being said. We don't know the full content, but I could see easily that there will be pastors who have engaged in a sort of banter, kind of coarse joking with their male friends that at one level ought to be equally sort of disqualifying as this kind of behavior. I think it raises into question the whole issue of how as a kind of a male church leader, how do you have relationships in the church with people from all kind of different kind of sort of sexes? I think there's an appropriate brother and sister relationship that needs to be reflected, but that's what it needs to be. And there are dangers of an intense individual one-to-one relationship with other people in the life of the church.
I would say that one of my best friends is a woman, very old, dear friend. I think there is a narrative within evangelicalism that says I as a man can't have a friendship with a woman of that kind. It could be acquaintances, could be church members together, but actually a friendship, that's crossing a line. I mean, that doesn't seem to me to be a biblical position.
Yeah,
there are obviously temptations and dangers and things to watch out for.
Yeah, and that's true. So we've got to remember, of course, there are some Christians who are same-sex attracted for whom an intense friendship with somebody of the same gender would be just as difficult. And I think a lot of the stuff that's spoken of about how to guard yourself against temptation basically assumes that everybody's temptations are primarily kind of heterosexual, whereas in reality, some of the biggest scandals, certainly within the UK Christian scene, have involved pastors basically engaging in behaviour that has a homosexual dimension to it. So I think we need to recognise that danger passes kind of both ways. In actual fact, I think from a perspective of marriage, we need a measure of caution about all the friendships that we have outside of our marriages, that our marriage partner needs to be the person with whom we have our primary relationship. Mm. Guarding that is important, and any friendship that in a sense impinges on that has a potential challenge to it. But yes, I think in our culture and world where people are working together alongside people who are both men and women, going to university, students, friendships form, and that is a good thing. Mm. We need to be modeling, I think, a proper biblical brother-sister friendship relationship that isn't sexualized. But I think the great danger is actually we can fall into sexualizing every relationship And actually, if we start from that perspective and see every relationship as potentially problematic in its own way, that ironically creates the very problem that it's seeking to avoid.
I think as well, Phil, just very, very briefly as we come to a close, I think it's worth reflecting how we as Christians hear and read about these kinds of things. Mm. I think there is a deep tendency to basically gossip or to kind of look at a situation and say, I told you so, and sort of gloat. You know, at least it's not me. And I think there's a proper place for lament. Mm. I'm just sort of been reading Jeremiah and Lamentations at the moment. And, you know, the gold has lost its luster, the fine gold becomes dull. That there are words of lament. And actually, when we see other Christians apparently falling, our initial reaction should not be, oh, well, I'm all right. Or even, oh, well, I'm not surprised it's them. Or, what, you know, that just goes to prove. It should be lament. There is a proper place for lamenting over the impact of sin on the gospel cause, I think. And that should be our primary reaction.
That's right. I think I put it in terms of there needs to be sorrow rather than schadenfreude.
That's right.
I think actually that's an even worse reaction. There are those who will look at this and say, well, I told you so. This is another kind of mega pastor that has been brought down. Almost a delighting and a rejoicing in that. There oughtn't to be. There needs to be sorrow for the honour of Christ that has been diminished, sorrow for the person concerned, sorrow for potential victims who've been involved, sorrow for the impact on the church family.
That's right.
Rather than a kind of a purient kind of delight and interest in it that masquerades as spiritual concern.
A somber note on which to finish, but an important one. Brothers, thank you very much. This has been Independence, the FIEC podcast. Thank you, John. Thank you, Adrian. If you've liked the podcast, do rate and review so that other people can find it. And we'll talk to you again very soon. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Phil.